Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
Hey everybody, Chad Wesley Smith here, the Jug Life Podcast, joined as always by the notorious MAX, Max Montana Ada.
How you guys doing?
And our guest today, Mr. Jeff Nichols. Jeff,
how you doing, bud? Good, good.
So Jeff is many, many things. Coach, former Navy SEAL, speaker, author?
Maybe? Kinda. I've written a forward for a book.
Author-ish.
Yeah, right. I'm working on a kid's book called Christmas Ninjas.
Nice. We'll come back to Christmas Ninjas. I got to meet Jeff for the first time maybe probably like 4 years ago.
4 years ago at Summer Strong?
Yeah, Summer Strong. We shared a very unique experience together. Are people allowed to this classified information?
No, it's not.
So one of my first interactions with Jeff was waterboarding someone, a volunteer. This was waterboarding by his own fruition, and I was actually concerned for myself. So my role in the waterboarding was to hold his arms down.
You were the arms or the leg? Because it was.
I think Brandon and I had his arms.
Yeah, and then Danielle Curry, I think, had a leg. Okay. Yeah, it was the world's strongest waterboarding.
Yeah. And the reason I say I was concerned for myself in it is concerned me for my own psychology, because I was just giggling the whole time at this man's, displeasure of what was going on.
Yeah, I think we're all a little bit surprised. And it just so you know, like, the angle of a decline bench is almost ideal for a waterboarding. So
the more you know. Right? Knowing is half the battle.
Exactly. So, yeah, that was 4 years ago.
Yeah, it was quite the... I mean, once you waterboarded someone, you're bonded for life.
Always.
Yeah. But, yeah, Jeff just recently sold his gym out in Virginia High Performance. And there's all kinds of stuff we want to talk to him about, from military training to what's going to be about the gnarliest list of injuries you've ever heard. As well as his kind of specialty, which is recovery and helping athletes improve their recovery. So, just give us a little bit of information about your own athletic background.
All right, probably not terribly unlike most strength coaches, if you are like our profession, I guess. Like, college athlete, played baseball at Troy University, stayed on. For various reasons, I stopped playing baseball. Just kind of a lot of friends struggling in the minor leagues, and that wasn't exactly my... I think the minor league minimum at the time was like $850 a month. And, I was a broke college student, but I wasn't a stupid college student, so $850 didn't seem like a whole lot of money.
Yeah.
So I didn't play professionally. I had an opportunity to play for the Braves and the Angels offered me a free agent contract after my junior year or whatever. But anyways, for me, I was a small child, stereotypical small child find the weight room kind of thing. I just always had a passion for training. So when my playing years ended, timing being what it was at Troy University was the first time that the university was offering an assistant strength coach position. I marched down there, and then Coach Shaughnessy, who's still down there, Richard Shaughnessy, is a program manager there. I was like, hey, coach, I'm working for you. And he's like, ironically enough, the university just gave me, he's like, so you want the job? Like, got it. Became an assistant strength coach there and stayed there for about a year and a half into grad school, and then I joined the Navy.
And in that time at Troy, did you overlap with, like, OC Umanura? Or?
He was there, yeah. So when my last year there, we'll call it, like, my first year of grad school, grad student, I left. DeMarcus Ware was there. It was his senior year. Osio Samuro was there. Lawrence Tynes. They were all there at the time, and that was
like pretty much the best people you could have gotten at Troy. Were all
for sure. They were all at one time, and that was interesting because I remember being an underclassman baseball player, and DeMarcus was there. he's pretty undersized, believe it or not. Like, he always had a crazy arm wingspan, but he wasn't the 270-pound guy.
Yeah, but looked more like a basketball player.
Yeah, super lanky, but he's one of those guys that, like, he is a byproduct, obviously, certain talent and genetics, but his work ethic is like nothing I've ever seen. And he deserves every sort of accolade that he's ever gotten, for sure.
So then you made the switch and entered the Navy. What kind of prompted that decision for you?
Well, I think that, when my sporting career ended, probably many of us, there's a part of you that's not really quite done to hang up that team uniform, I guess. So I don't know what it was as a child, or I guess older adolescence. It's kind of like, it's like difficult training. I kind of, I'm almost 40 now. So when I was 12, 13 years old, the internet was like in its infancy, or not even like 95, 96 timeline, right? I was in high school. There wasn't much to be said or heard or even thought about the SEAL community, but there was always like that very small whisper. And my girlfriend at the time's dad was an Army like major in the reserves, and he had a SEAL friend, and you kind of hear those like those urban legends about them.
This mythical,
these beast. Unicorns, those purple unicorns kind of thing. So that sort of mystique appealed to me on whatever level. That seed was planted at a young age.
And
there was a point in time where that drive to do something that was supposed to be impossible, right? I was always very good at working harder than everyone because I was so undersized. Like, my senior of high school, I wrestled 103 pounds. Wow. Being raised in Iowa, that was a bit of a fight. So I found my way there because, long and short question is, I just wasn't ready to not be a part of a team.
Okay.
And that, to me, seemed like one of those transitions where, now there's certainly some skill involved in that professional lifestyle, but the entry into the opportunity to getting, is effort-driven.
Right.
Right. So, and I was good at that, right? Working my ass off, and so it appealed to me. And in retrospect, it makes even more sense now. Like, I think I gained a lot more. Like, I always think, like, a person will be attracted to a sport for a reason, but what keeps them in sport or keeps them in a profession that typically will change, right? As your priority change and lifestyle, and the more you learn, so. It changed over years, why I stayed and why I kept doing what I was doing, but my reasons for going in really was just I wasn't ready to sit behind a desk and, make other people money.
Yeah.
So, here we go. I joined the military.
And, of course, as people know, the first step, the most infamous step of the Navy SEAL process is BUDS. So, and, we see that in movies or on TV shows, but What is the day in the life of a BUDS cadet?
Student, I guess. I mean, I think that the process is 27 weeks. Now, it's changed a little bit in the sense of, there was BUDS, and then there was Jump Squirrel, and then there's what's called SQT, SEAL Qualification Training. They were separate segments of training. Now they've kind of all been lumped together from beginning to end. It takes about a year or so, given the time of year and so forth. But any given day really is just, it's not meant to be fun, because I think the misconception is that, like, especially on the training side, I know we're going to get to that, is that the belief that BUDS is this forging process that teaches people to have this mental fortitude and understand is, BUDS is purely a deselection process. It deselects people to get to the people that community is willing to train and invest in.
Right.
And so it's now there's some positive learning experiences involved on the tail end of BUDS. You learn to manage firearms and certain things, but especially early on, like what the world sees as BUDS is like Hell Week and all these sort of things. And it's certainly not a test of, like, it's not a teaching environment. It's a testing environment to get people to fail to get to the people.
Right.
It's deselection. Right. So, I mean, the first couple weeks are just, they're long, they're awful, they're cold. And there's no time. And I think it's a big thing is there's the military in itself. Someone that joins the military, even sport, like think of a freshman going to college away from home. Like, there's this massive adjustment, like college life, sport life. And if you've never learned, like, weight training, so that's a big another adjustment. when guys come into Buds, especially the 18, 19-year-old kids who have, you know, they may have played high school sports, but they've never lived on their own. They never had to pay their own bills, never had to do these sort of things. And now you're thrust in this environment where it's not just difficulty of Buds, but away from home and all that. Like,
yeah.
I don't know that I would have quit when I was 18, because I was 22 when I went through. But I certainly was glad I didn't try when I was 18.
Right.
But there's that physical, that emotional, mental, like, maturity that I had achieved through college. But, yeah, it sucked in its own right. Anyone that tells you otherwise is lying to you. But for me being 22... in its own right, it sucked, but it wasn't terrible. Like, I narcissistically kind of enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, it suited me.
What's, like, an average age for guys graduating Buds?
I would say it's probably 21, maybe 20. And I, talking to some of the guys I train now in preparation for Buds, the washout rate is about 85%, and that hasn't changed. It's always been that since the 60s.
Right.
But I believe that the success rate for guys that are coming from the fleet is a bit higher. And I think that's probably attributed to, again, a little bit of, they're a little bit older, a little bit more mature, and they know, like, if they end up leaving or quitting Buds, well, they got to go back to. Not that the Navy's bad, not right. by any means, but in contrast, the freedoms that I was afforded being, like, long hair and a beard and never really had a uniform on and just kind of that lifestyle is appealing. But I think that, you know, that I think there's a push now for a little bit older guys to get through because the success rate is a little bit higher. But again, that's the people that are hosting that training environment hasn't changed a whole lot. Like, they get the keys of the city, right? And I'm like, yeah, so there's no, like, online Buds training, so you're gonna have to show up and still get through the gauntlet.
Right.
And something you mentioned about the deselection process, and it kind of being more about the revealing the people who already are capable, already, you know, capable of doing what needs to be done. I see athletes and coaches try and implement Navy SEAL type of training, or they hire, you know, former SEALs to come do stuff to try and teach athletes mental toughness. Yeah. Do you think that there is a trainable quality to mental toughness?
Yeah, I think that, well, I think oftentimes it's misdirected, number one. And I guess I'll answer it in my way to really get to the point is that, you know, to get that transference, if you will, of the SEAL methodology or mentality into athletics, it's one thing, like, hey, I'm not going to teach anyone to be mentally tough.
Right.
And there's kind of a reason to that. But really what we're looking at is the process. And I think the biggest goal is to say, okay, at the end of it, we're going to forge a certain individual, just like we do in sport. And we're able to almost guarantee a successful group of people because that process from inception is so tried and true. It's the process. And again, like the Buds or the SEAL community, success is not proprietary to us. Success is proprietary to successful people, whether it's sport or it's the you know, the business world. Right? Success is not happenstantial. And so I guess that's my long answer to your short question is that, you know, what we do, in my opinion, better than anybody else in the world, in my former community, is that the process is so good. It's so refined. It's watched by people that are already in that community, right? Like the gatekeepers. And that's what you start seeing in, you know, I've seen behind the scenes on the Golden State Warriors. I've been behind the scenes with the Patriots and certain other organizations, and their process is so very good. And I think that people get so wrapped around the idea of getting people mentally tough that they forget that the recipe, you know, if you omit the sugar on a cake, it's going to be a really shitty cake.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So,
like a vegan cake.
It's just awful, right? Gluten-free vegan nonsense, right? So I guess that's kind of my philosophical way of answering your question is that we can infuse mental toughness, and this is so far away from me being religious, but bear with me here. It's like, you know, and someone will say, "Well, I'm praying for patience." Well, kind of the way I look at it is like, well, you're going to have a lot of opportunity to be patient. So every time that you express patience, you're going to gain patience. And the same thing with mental toughness is that, the especially in sport and especially in training, there's all these moments of difficulty. If you choose to take on that and achieve and achieve and achieve, or set yourself even up for success, not make it easy, right? Especially like, you know, the methodology in which you guys train, you don't like have your athletes come in every week and just put the fucking screws to them and see, because I'm the coach, right? You want to give them constant and linear, if you will, milestones for progression. That's what we've gotten away from in this tactical strength and training. Is like, oh my God, my hair's on fire, and all we're doing is flipping tire. I wear body armor to 7-Eleven because I have the tough. You gotta be kidding me. I get silliness.
Right.
So, you know, that's where the mental toughness comes in. Like, you either have it or you don't, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But if you're going to forge it,
it's almost more of forging like a readiness, a preparedness to all these potential situations that could come about. Whatever the, you know, Navy SEAL situations require a certain preparedness for that. Powerlifting, weightlifting, football, all that stuff. It's like you have to, the more well-rehearsed, well-processed you've been to be ready for your circumstance.
For sure.
Is going to be kind of, I guess, what really expresses itself as that mental toughness.
Yeah, and it's that, I guess, the term that's been used is stress inoculation, I guess, is, you know, Dave Grossman won a Pulitzer for On Killing. The more you're exposed to stressful events and you come out the other end successful or pseudo-successful, as those stressful events come on, you actually get less and less and less stressed. And a lot of that is through routine. So, like, every time, look at Ilian every time he approaches the bar, for example. It's exactly the same.
Right.
Look at LeBron James every time he shoots a free throw or whatever. Pick any athlete. The same every time before you get under a bar, your breathing process is the same. Because if you're constantly dropping those cookie crumbs that like lead you to success, if you have to go, all right, like baseball, for example, or you get under the bar, if you need to reset, what do? You step back, reset. Pick up those cookie crumbs you left off. Yeah. A lot of people think that, well, no, I just, you know, I'm just going to work really hard and like thrust myself in this athletic endeavor and be like, I don't know why I wasn't successful. Because you have no idea. You just fucking did.
Yeah.
You just threw yourself in it. And that's where like every step of the way in my community, my former community, is that as the difficulty or severity gets ratcheted up, you have these really amazing mentors with you going, hey, like this stuff's been written in blood. And we've learned from this. Don't fuck this up, or you're going to get yourself or somebody else killed.
Right.
That mentorship process is so very good in our community because we all started in the same place, like at Buds.
Right.
So it's not happenstantial.
Sounds a lot like what we talk about a lot, and especially in training, is like process orientation versus goal orientation, where people come in the gym and like, oh, my goal is to snatch whatever 100 kilos or something. And there's a fixation only on the end result, what they're going to get.
Yes.
Versus, if I'm going to snatch 100 kilos, I have to do this thing right and that thing right. And then each little process becomes the focus. And when all the processes start to happen correctly and over and over and over again, you end up at that final goal, but as a byproduct, not the sole endeavor, right?
That's adaptation.
Yeah.
Right? And that's... There's a book called Attainment. It's a very small book called Attainment. It talks about a process. And I learned that a long time ago. Kind of, I guess maybe it was happenstantially in my community because the community, the way they forge people is good.
Yeah.
But I did a TED Talk last November on this very thing. It was like, you know, we think that success is happenstantial, but it's so far from, like, you start dissecting your lifting career, your coaching career. Like, you're in this position not because it was given to you, but because you refined your process is better than your peers. Right. And that's what people are trying to find from you all. When they come seek you out as coaches, it's not because you direct... I mean, we can say that an athlete's success is pseudo-directly or directly correlated to your coaching principles. But it's really what they're trying to find. They're trying to get your process based off of their needs.
Right.
That's what they're trying to get. And I think that that's the message that the tactical community is really good at having and maintaining. They're just former guys and are not very good at sharing that. And I think a lot of that's because they probably didn't have the mentorship. They just had the veteran status. Right. And it's no disrespect to our veterans, because that's not the point at all. Because we are, as veterans, I think, a really set up for success because of the perspective we've been given. Like, I don't stress out over shit. I don't. And that, it's given me that, so I'm thankful.
Yeah.
And you started to touch on this for a second, but talking about this sort of ridiculous things you see being done in tactical type of training. What are some lacking aspects you see maybe in the physical aspect of BUDS training or in military training?
Yeah, I think that it's pretty simple in my opinion. I think that the training is so very difficult for deselection. What ends up happening is that process of forging these tactical athletes, we'll call them the active duty guys and men and women, when they get through that selection process, they're like, just like another athlete, they get so attached to what made them successful,
right.
They continue to try to do that, and they just overtrain too often, right? So that's why I say, like with an athlete, what got you to be successful, what got you in the NFL or NBA, it's not going to keep you there. You have to refine your process. And so the tactical population, like, that's all we know we're good at is just that grind, like just to beat the hell out of ourselves. But that doesn't bode well at all for longevity. Right. It doesn't bode well at all for fatigue resistance. And it doesn't at all bode well for injury resistance training. But that's what we're comfortable with because that's what got us there. It's like, well, like, I found very quickly in the professional world the fastest way to lose professional athletes and the tactical population is one. Whether they realize or not, you're not attacking them. You're going, hey, man, you shouldn't train like that. You're going to be like, whoa, wait a minute. Like, I was pretty successful getting here. Or you go, yeah, you probably shouldn't eat like that. And they'd be like, hey, wait a minute. That's how you're going to lose someone right away. And the tactical population is the same way. They'd be like, fuck you, man. I went through BUDS. I can do it like I'm a fitness ninja. Okay, because your ability to endure that nonsense, we'll call BUDS being nonsense if we'll call it that, is a testament to the human resiliency for a short period of time. You cannot continue to train like that or you'll break. I mean, it's kind of like the Bulgarian method, right? Yeah. You know, they're outliers, certainly. They can endure that their whole life and come out the back end because they're superhuman.
Right.
But for the majority of us, we've got to be a little bit smarter about the way we train because otherwise we're going to break before we get to our 40s.
Right.
Our skeletal system isn't necessarily meant to break down in our 20s, but you see it a lot.
Yeah.
And we have kids having Tommy John surgery as young as 12 now in the United States, and that's just absurd. So I blame the parents for some of that, but that's a whole other subject of ranting on my part. But, I mean, I think that it is my belief that we do not focus nearly enough on healing the human mechanism because so much is focused on, hey, well, for me to get the end result of high performance, I just need to train really hard.
Right.
But we don't, again, and it's not like I need to, for every hour I need to train, I need to spend an hour on recovery. Right, it's a little bit more complex than that, in my opinion. But
you feel like people just try to. It seems like the word recovery is kind of I don't want to say a catch-all, but it's like, yeah. Oh, just throw this like it's like a thing you do. Like, oh, I'm doing recovery.
Yeah.
Like I did training. I do recovery, and they're interchangeable. I can just do any kind of recovery rather than
yep.
Recovery is something that's essentially, I mean, you know, fatigue management and whatnot. But recovery is something that's programmed into the overall structure of the training process, right?
I mean, I think it's no different than, hey, if you need to improve your power, right? We don't do general adaptation training. You're not going to do that. You're not going to achieve that goal,
right?
Because we can look at recovery. It is a catch-all. It's like this buzzword, and
right. It's
almost impossible to define. But if you look at, well, as you're a coach or you're assimilating as an athlete, how you actually are feeling and moving and, right, how you're digesting food, how are you sleeping, how, you know, is your mood swing, have you done blood work, all these sort of assessment tools that we have in our possession. And there's a ton of, you know, biomarkers machines we can particularly buy or whatever. But just like we can focus specifically on improving our endurance or power and strength or whatever it may be, we can look at what's going on with the nervous system and improve that. We can look specifically on how we're sleeping, right? Macro and micronutrients is a big part of that gut health. That's a lane we can go down to. But the what ends up happening is because we all lump them all together, like, oh yeah, I'm doing a foam roller. That it completely uncovers my recovery umbrella.
Yeah.
And it's selling the body short.
Right.
Because just like, hey, well, I need to bench press 700 pounds.
Is this even if the foam roller has a lot of bumps on it?
Yeah, right. No, yeah, that's a game changer,
yeah. For
sure. It vibrates, right? Or you can put cold stuff inside of it, yeah. Or it's got like a built-in, you know, water bottle / shake weight / foam roller, whatever it is. You know, we just lump everything in together like it's a catch-all.
Yeah.
And the amount of stress we put on the human body, it's too damn smart for that.
Right.
So I just think it's ignorant because we'll spend so much time really finitely programming somebody appropriately to get that adaptation. But we're like, yeah, no, like you just there's some water over there and some you know, some roller, you just roll around for a bit, you'd be good, have a nap.
Right.
Just doesn't work that way. So
it's too bad.
Yeah, I wish, right?
That would be so much nicer.
Get a pillow, issue a pillow and a blanket for everyone.
So as you look at, you know, the need for tactical athletes, for sport athletes, for recovery, what are maybe some of the things you see people doing that's maybe a waste of time and things that maybe you see people not doing enough of?
Ooh, waste of time. Let's see here. That's kind of... I think that's more determinant on... Like, again, it's not that we're going to say formaling is a waste of time, but, like, for bigger guys like us, if you have some lower back issues, right, especially, like, you're going to need somebody else probably to manipulate that soft tissue and that bony structure to get it adjusted, right? So if the recovery doesn't... isn't aggressive enough... Or if it's just non-specific, I think that, I mean, you know, from as far as a recovery modality that I think is a waste of time, man, I think maybe a foam roller for a bigger guy like you and I.
Yeah. I guess maybe to expand the idea for the people listening and watching is... You know, recovery is its own term and maybe hard to define, but it's the other part of it that people don't talk about as much as recovery adaptive strategy.
Yes.
Because you know, recover, to me, I would define recovery as just back to baseline.
Yes.
But no one who's you know watching or listening to this gives a shit about just coming back to baseline over and over and over.
Yeah.
They care about adapting to something greater.
See, I always kind of lump this together. Like, we could take the wonkiest training program. If you put a good coach in that and share that with athletes, it might actually turn out to be pretty effective. So the same thing is like any sort of recovery modality where you're using stim, ice, cryo, sensory deprivation, blood flow restriction. You know, just diaphragmatic breathing, like the whole litany of things we could do. But if they're not, it's like for the same reason, like I know I heard you say once, and I fully concur, is that if you had wished or if you had learned years ago how to breathe better.
Yeah.
You know, but someone says, you know, you're a child or you're on the mound and your dad's like, your coach is like, just relax, take 3 deep breaths. But it's never, the mechanism is never really taught. It's not super complex.
Right.
But that's the thing, is that light bulb goes on when you're under the bar and someone really teaches you how to breathe appropriately to prepare that brain for stress, right? Because you start getting these physical manifestations of stress, yawning, indigestion, heartburn, frequent diarrhea, right? Frequent urination, no urination, constipation. There's all these GI issues that go along that can really be mitigated by proper breathing, but you don't reap the benefits until you've been taught.
Right.
So that's kind of where it's like, if you're just going to foam roll, you're just wasting your fucking time. Without, okay, there's a process to it. Like, what are we trying to achieve? If we're not achieving that, move on. Because you might need more stimulus.
Right.
Right? Just doing a cold plunge isn't going to work. If someone hates water, not going to work. Right? You're going to create more of a sympathetic nervous system response. So you've got to take, my soliloquy is over when I say, we can't be programmed the same way. You have different needs than I do. If you were programming for us. So recovery is the same way. You have to look at the individual and go, okay, what is this person's needs?
Right.
Because you can be wasting someone's time, and that's the last thing we need. As much time we put in training, we don't want to waste anyone's time.
Right, right.
You know, one of the really cool things I think you've got going on now is, as I mentioned before, you recently sold your stake in your gym. But I mean, tell people about VHP and what you've done there the last couple of years, and then this sort of coaching knowledge quest that you'll be on for the next while.
Yeah, David Carradine without the Thailand visit. Yeah. So, well, maybe. We might know the back end of it. But, my former business partner and I is like one of my closest friends, and you know, he and I both had an unofficial position within Naval Special Warfare running components of the human performance program, the recovery side and some other things. And so when we got out, we're, you know, both of us back in Virginia Beach, we look at it and go, well, you know, at the time he had a daughter playing pretty high-level volleyball, junior volleyball, and so we got asked to do some camps for him and stuff, and it grew and grew, and we didn't have a facility. So we put a facility in, worked with a lot of young athletes in the Virginia Beach area and surrounding areas.
And what was about the most well-equipped? I've only seen photos, but
yeah, we
looked to me about the most well-equipped facility.
We didn't skimp. We were really blessed because we had a gentleman that we have befriended over the years that was an angel investor and gave us a good bit of cash to take care of. So we everything is Sornex and play, and we just because we the reason why, and it's not to knock anyone else, but we looked at the majority of professional and amateur weight rooms, right, in college, and we go because we're our initial goal was just prepare a lot of because Hampton Roads, the Virginia Beach area, is a juggernaut, for lack of a better term, no pun I guess maybe it is intended, for high school athletics.
Yeah,
like it's big time football, baseball, and track.
This, this would be Allen Iverson, Ronald Curry,
DJ and Justin Upton, Michael, Kadir, Zimmerman, all these baseball players. Plexico Burris. I mean, the list goes on and on of guys coming out of there. Yeah. So, and still more. But so we were looking at it going, we have so many athletes going into high-level athletics. Let's put a facility that, you know, whether they're going to Clemson or they're going to South Carolina or Berkeley, whatever it is, right? Like, they have the equipment and flooring and space and layout. And also the process and structure is the same. So we can prepare these athletes for future competition. So that's what we went with. And then... It was well received. Word of mouth is very powerful, but also can kill you and crush you if you don't, you know, run the business right. Like I'm not very empathetic with whiny parents. Now I love the kids, I appreciate, but it also we got to a point where, you know, my direction and kind of my segue into what I'm doing now got to the point where, you know, as much as I love my I had some strength coaches that work with me. They're some of the best young strength coaches in the country, in my opinion. Like, they're really good, wonderful people and good coaches. And I kind of got to the point where I didn't feel like, you know, in the sense of, like, you get a young strength coach working here, for example, and they've got a lot to learn and keep up and catch up. It's not that I know everything, but I felt like I just professionally was kind of at this crossroads of, like, I want to learn more. So... talking to my business partner, I was like, hey, this is kind of the direction I want to go. He wanted to maintain the facility, and I certainly wanted to see it continue to grow and for our strength coaches to have a great place to develop their skill. So I was like, hey, I'll go my separate way. You take all the rest of the ownership. I'll sell my side. And then now I'm basically, from now until whenever, a year maybe is kind of the timeline I'm giving myself to, again, spend time with you guys and going to see Mark Bell next week and just going to travel the country and spend some time like a fly on the wall with people that I've always wanted to just watch. You know, not steal anything from them, but just like I just feel like I got a lot to learn. Mm-hmm. I really want. I've been doing this now for 17 years as a strength coach. But I just feel like I've got a lot more to learn. So that's my quest for who knows how long. I've been afforded, you know, financially I'm in a decent place where I don't have a whole lot of debt, right? And I'm just going to go learn. I don't know. Stay tuned because, hell, I don't know what I'm exactly going to do just yet. So all I want to do is, like, I want to dance. No, I just want to coach and I want to learn.
Yeah.
And
that's cool.
That's what I'm doing.
That's very cool.
That's going to be a very awesome trip. The one thing we forgot here, which I gotta get to, is back to your military career. You sustained all the injuries.
How would you get all of them?
Yeah. Give us a little rundown here.
Yeah, I had a couple of combat deployments, we'll say, and the wear and tear. I've documented 17 concussions. And various the military classifies those as loss of consciousness.
That's the first time I met you. It was not at Sornex. It was at the TSAC.
Yes, in San Diego. Briefly introduced.
Because,
yeah, that's right.
Because this is one of almost the first things that Jeff ever said to me is we're talking, and you said, you're like, well, I had 17 concussions, so if I kind of trail off at any point here, please forgive me.
Yeah.
I was like, holy shit.
Yeah, I had some that were really pretty acute, and like I don't remember for a couple of days kind of thing, bleeding out of my eyes and ears and stuff. A little too close to a blast.
Right.
And a few other things, and some falls and crashes and so on. You know, the risk goes on and on. A lot of torn ligaments and, you know, herniated discs, broken bones. I've got some frag in my eye. That's why it's got some weird brownness to it, and some bullet holes and so forth. So, I mean, it's weird, though, because I think, like an injured athlete, a lot of good comes out of necessity from it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a stupid, I mean, I say it out loud, but like I'm kind of thankful that I got the hell kicked out of me, because it forced me to really have to relearn my basics. You know, it's like I was a young, strong guy, and I just thought that I was pretty much impenetrable, and I could squat heavy weights and push this and overtrain all the time, because I was like, and it's stupid because I knew better. I mean, with my professional training as a, you know, a CSCS and an exercise physiologist from college, like I just wasn't taking my own medicine until I got to the point where I was opiate addicted, like severely. Now, that's my fault. I'm not passing blame on our military. That was my doing. No one else's. My choice to deal with my back pain and my shoulder pain and so forth. And it got pretty severe for a while. You know, hair was falling out, fingernails, and just my wounds weren't healing. And I met a very good friend of mine, Dr. John Sullivan, who is the sports psychologist for the Patriots for years. You know, it's a long story, but just the short, very, very short, is just that I had someone that had worked in the world of concussions and hockey and the NFL and European football that I got to talk to, and he had seen it. And he looked at me and was like, he had already, this is a conversation I've had after. He's the forward. I wrote his book, forward for his book. And he knew right away, like, the type of individual I was. And, like, my short-term memory was gone, right? I couldn't finish sentences. I'd stand up to go do something, I'd forget where I was going. Like, I'd get up to go to the bathroom, I'd forget, kind of thing. Like, really, I could be in my car, my truck driving, and I'm like, I don't even know where I'm going. It happened all the time, and I'm telling him this just, and I never talked about myself in that regard, just because you're guarded, you know, you don't want people to see those weaknesses. And right away, he's just helping me create a process for those solutions. And still to this day, somebody I lean on. And, you know, that's the big thing for me, is despite all of my injuries, because then you start seeing these sort of watermarks that exist in sport and athletes, the forgetfulness, or the lack of attention, and you start seeing digestion issues with people, a lot of chronic sleep issues in sport, and they've never been empowered with that process, because, you know, that process of getting them on the field or court or on the platform, it's almost set for them. But you get these 22-year-old guys that get, you know, $60-80 million, and they're just like, keep being awesome, and they don't even know how to, because they were just that much better talent-wise. You start getting to the upper level of NFL in places, and that talent pool, you know, there's outliers, of course, but that talent pool gets a little bit more sparse.
Yeah.
It's just because they're all good. Right? You watch football, and they don't look so big. You stand in an NFL locker room, you're like, holy Christ, these guys are monsters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because they all look, you know, all the same size on TV.
Yeah.
So, anyways, that's the, you know, kind of my story about injury, is that, you know, If there's a lot of guys that have fared far worse than me. My trauma, I'm a testament to resilience now. Like I said, I'm almost 40. My cella was destroyed, which is the sac that the pituitary sits in, or is ruptured, not destroyed. So that fluid sits in there, and the patella sits, and it doesn't hold fluid. So my body doesn't regulate hormones right, testosterone, growth hormone, certain things. So I have to, I'm prescribed very low doses of a lot of different hormones. And I feel great. Like, CPAP is like the greatest thing ever. It's like, because I have severe sleep apnea, because my nose has been broken, all these sort of things. I'm almost 40. I'm 39, and I feel fantastic for someone that's 39. Like, I feel really good. So, that's the thing. As I look at some of the, I say older, you know, I think that's the beauty of our profession and some of the sport is now you start seeing this, there is this progression of increasing in age and still maintaining a higher level of performance because, you know, we'll call it recovery. People's awareness of how they're taking care of themselves is improving. And I think it's like, we live in a great time of performance and training. I think it's awesome.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
It's a lot of injuries.
One or two. Yeah. So I have a thick medical record. Yeah. So.
Damn. Any from sport? Like any injuries in sport, you know, or all from?
Not really. Seals? I mean, I played baseball in college. I was a catcher. My knees are good.
Yeah.
My hip, you know, pre-injury stuff. I never even broke a bone until I joined the Navy. So
you made up for it.
I did. I certainly did. Yeah, I caught up. Yeah, I'm not lagging in that department of injuries now. But no, like I swam. I swam a lot in college. Yeah. Or I'm sorry, in high school. I swam probably for 15 years, and I think a lot of that was good in the water. Really good in the water. I was good on the ground. I was just small and angry. Just angry redheaded kid.
Were you angry about how small and redheaded you
were? I was. Not so much the red hair. I'm a bit of a day walker. Like, I don't burn. I don't burn like the normal redhead. But, I was... My dad was a big farm kid. I didn't get those genes.
Yeah.
I got my mom's genes. Small and skinny. So, here we are.
Well, Jeff, where can people learn more from you? Learn more about you?
Yeah, I guess my easiest way to find me is probably Instagram. JeffCSCS. Facebook... I kind of monitor, but not really. And then, I get so many questions, and I'm happy to get them, you know, about the tactical strength conditioning, because I do a lot of teaching for the NSCA on the tactical strength conditioning side. I started a YouTube channel because I get so many frequently asked questions, and out of respect, I try to answer everybody thoroughly, but it's pretty time-consuming.
Yeah.
So now I'm trying to collect, you know, my videos online. People ask a lot about programming and progressions and recovery, and sleep is on there. Just, you know, 5-10 minute videos on YouTube. And so it's easier for me now and saves a lot of time and effort. And it answers their questions much better where I can just direct them to the YouTube channel.
Nice.
So, or you can find me in Virginia Beach. Well, I'm not giving out my address because I just moved and no one knows my address. We'll leave it at that.
Yeah, I feel like that.
Probably not the best idea to come to my house unless you're invited. Probably not the best idea. The door's unlocked, but you can, let's just say Virginia is not California.
Yeah.
You may not leave my house.
Well, great. What's the title of your TED Talk so people can go find that?
It is Purpose, Process, and Love of a Navy SEAL.
All right, so
very cool.
Make sure you check out that TED Talk from Jeff. Go ask him all the questions you can on Instagram. Max, where can they find you?
Yes, you can find me on Instagram, Max_Ada, or on Facebook. You can email me, MaxJTSStrength, for any kind of questions or whatnot. And you can check out... JuggernautOnlineCoaching.com for information on the Juggernaut. Oh.
Juggernaut Coaching.
Juggernaut Coaching. I always like to add words to JTS and whatnot.
Juggernaut Strength Training Systems of.
If you get questions about the programs.
Make sure you guys check out Max's new book, Weightlifting Technique Triad. You can find that at store.jtsstrength.com. If you enjoy the podcast, please go on iTunes, give us a 5-star review. We're also on Spotify now, so you can find us there. Visit juggernautcoaching.com, no online part, or Juggernaut Online Coaching on Instagram. Maybe I'll change the Instagram.
That's the problem. Juggernaut
Coaching.
That's the problem.
I know. It's a lack of continuity. I apologize. Please subscribe to our YouTube and share this video with your friends. Jeff, thanks for coming.
My pleasure.
Yep. Absolutely.
I'm Chad Wesley Smith, at Chad Wesley Smith and at Juggernaut Training on Facebook and Instagram. Filling up your news feed all day. We will see you next week. That's it.